On today's Question of Faith, why are young adults leaving the church? Happy New Year, everybody. This is Question of Faith. I am Mike Hayes. I'm the Director of Young Adult Ministry here in the Diocese of Cleveland.
And I'm Father Damian Ferentz, a Vicar for Evangelization.
And I'm Christy Cabanis, the Director of Missionary Discipleship.
And you're new.
I am new. I just started.
You did.
Welcome aboard. Where are you from? Tell us a little bit about yourself before we get going here.
Oh, gosh. So I'm from Greensburg, Pennsylvania. Yes, there is some Bishop Malesa connection, but I didn't come here for him exactly.
Oh,
I came
right.
here for this work, which I'm very excited about. I'm married 27 years and have two young adult children myself. I love my dog, Charlie.
Aw, Charlie the dog. What kind of dog is Charlie?
Well, he's really a mutt, but I like to pretend he's a particular breed, but we won't get into that today.
Yes.
That's very Cleveland of you. We've all had our mutts.
Yeah. We call that a generic dog, as my pet expert friend Warren Eckstein would say.
It's common people.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Absolutely.
He's every dog.
Yeah.
That's
and
right.
So we had a question that someone wrote in during one of our workshops that said, are young adults leaving the church because they're dissatisfied with the Catholic Church? Or do they just not believe in God anymore?
Mm.
Maybe not even anymore. Just, you know, do they just not believe in God? It does say anymore on the card, but, you know. So what do we think? I want to say yes to both of those.
Yes, you know? Exactly. I think.
That depends, you know, on who they are and what they're doing. But, yeah.
Yeah, I think we'll find the answer in the next 20 minutes.
That's why that's why we do this.
Right to the bottom of it.
No, but, I mean, I think one of my things that I would say in my experience is that, you know, young adults in general, many of them, not all of them, but many of them come to us with little or no religious experience sometimes. They weren't, you know, their family, it was never really part of their family. Things are symbols are unfamiliar to them. And so they come with less baggage maybe, but they also come with less familiarity in some cases. So like when I was the director of campus ministry at Canisius College, when the freshmen would come in and they would be like, some of them would, they chose the school particularly because it was Catholic. It was always part of their life. It was always part of their family thing. They were part of a parish. They did youth ministry. That was a very small number of people, maybe 2% of the whole population. The vast majority were people who didn't mind church, never mind Catholicism. You know, it was, you know, like secondhand smoke at the airport. You know, it's around. You know,
right.
it's around, but you know, it's not really something I always engage in or want to engage in. But if it's there, I can deal with it. I can go to a wedding. I can go to a funeral. I can even go to church sometimes. But it's not it's never been the be all or end all of my experience.
Right. There's no sense of deeper meaning there or a driving force to your life, kind of deriving its essence from what your religious belief is. I think one of the things that to that point, Mike, about whether we grew up with it or not around it or they're not practiced in it, I hear parents say often, you know, oh, we'll let the children decide when they get to a certain age. And I think, and I have had this conversation with parents, you are teaching your children by your practice or lack thereof. So, you know, I don't think it's a fair decision about if they're not making a decision, actually. So either they grew up with faith as part of the practice, and so they know what that is. And like, say, if you have a Methodist and a Catholic that are married to each other, the primary practice is what that child will grow up to understand. And that's probably, you know, where they'll be. But and when there is no practice, and I see this, I've seen it at weddings, often with young adults especially, my heart breaks because they're so uncomfortable because they're not familiar with the ritual and they're not familiar with the practice. And so then they don't know what to do and they feel awkward and like they don't belong. And no one wants that.
Yeah. And angry.
Sometimes irritated, to the point of anger.
Almost all the students I dealt with said that they didn't grow up with any rule, that their parents just said, well, we'll let them choose. They said they were really angry at their parents made that decision because they grew up with literally nothing.
Right.
And so, yeah.
And so then they grow up to a point where they're really searching, they're looking for that. There's more than just this horizontal plane of understanding our lives of there's an answer for everything and there's a solution to everything, but there must be something deeper here, and I have no idea how to even begin to scratch that surface.
That's what I say, they don't know where to start.
Yeah.
So that's young adults who've kind of been maybe not even affected by the church. Never mind disaffected, right?
Yeah.
What about the disaffection part? That's what the person seems to be asking as well, is that there are young adults who are disaffecting for certain reasons.
Do we know the reasons that young adults are claiming that they don't want to be part of the church? I mean, I know the big ones are like what we'd call the pelvic issues, right? The issues of sexuality, particularly gay marriage, LGBT things, mm-hmm. and also the science question.
Yeah, right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, we're working with the Catholic high schools right now, and we're doing like a 3-part series with all the 5 diocesan Catholic high schools, so Holy Name, Leary Catholic, Lake Catholic, Central Catholic, and VASJ. And we're going to be hitting some of these hot-button issues. Mm. But one of the things that I wanted to do before we got in any of that was I thought, well, geez, okay, so maybe people disagree with the church's teaching on certain issues of sexuality or even anthropology. And I wanted to say, what about the belief that God exists and that he became human, mm. was born of a virgin, lived, loved, suffered, died, rose from the dead, never to die again? And this happened in history. Do we believe those things that we profess after the homily every Sunday at Mass? And if not, let's start there, because that's the core of our faith. That's the kerygma. Mm-hmm. So if someone doesn't believe the kerygma, it would make sense to me that when it comes to our ethics or our moral theology, someone might say, I don't buy any of that. Well, all those teachings rest upon this belief in God as creator, God as Trinity, God as communion of persons as love, and that his second person took on flesh. So I think we've failed fairly miserably in presenting the kerygma as a church in recent years. In fact, last night I was reading the newest issue of Faith and Culture, which is Bishop Barron's journal.
Sure.
And in there, he has his introductory paragraph. He says in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there was so much energy and so much fight over these hot-button issues. And not that they're unimportant, because they are important, mm-hmm. but they rest upon the more important fundamental reality of who God is and who we are in God's relationship, that we focus so much on ethics that we forgot about evangelizing and introducing people to the person of Jesus Christ. So I think we're reaping the fruits of those mistakes. And I think this is why Pope Francis, and it's not like Pope Benedict or Pope John Paul II or Paul VI weren't doing this, but Pope Francis is really trying to get us back to the kerygma, because it's through the person of Christ that we're going to open hearts and lives are going to be transformed.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. In light of the kerygma, we have to look at all of those other issues, you know, going forward. And if we don't, then, well, we're sort of like sheep without a shepherd, literally, you know. We're sort of walking around baseless. You know, well, wait a minute. We're not basing this on anything. We're just basing this on how we feel, maybe, you know.
Yeah, I think that there's an aspect of this to back it up even further before you get to the kerygma is, does God even exist? And that's been a struggle of our modern culture, has been that there's been this replacement of either you can believe in science,
correct,
or you can believe in God. And so you have, you're forced to choose rather than realizing that science points to some kind of intelligence and creation and a particular thought process to how the whole thing came down. And I think, you know, there's a Canadian philosopher named Charles Taylor, uh-huh, that's done a whole bunch of research about how secularity has kind of infected our culture, and that we have come to a point with secularity where it's that all belief is it's a sense of that all belief should be contested, and a sense for fragility around, you know, a person that would say that they believe in something transcendent. So then you get to a struggle of, and especially as much as education has expanded, which is an amazing thing, but, you know, by and large, the more educated a person is, the less likely that they are to consent to a belief in God at all.
Yeah, sort of like an anti-intellectualism that is associated with religious people in some ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a trend. You were talking about this earlier in our offices. I could remember that, like, when someone would say that they were an atheist, even if they were like a prolific atheist, you know, someone who was in the media, they'd say, well, look, if you want to believe in that religion thing, go ahead. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't seem, you do you, I'm fine. I think you're an idiot for believing in that, right? But I don't care if you believe in it or not. Then suddenly, like in the recent, maybe the past 10, 15 years, there was a turn there with these sort of the neo-Darwinists, you know, all these guys like Dawkins and all this, and they sort of became kind of nasty about it, you know. It sort of became like, you know, well, if you believe in that, you're just an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, wait a minute, we can't even have this conversation now because you don't want to talk to me. You just think I'm an idiot. You just dismiss everything.
Yeah.
And those guys, we just talked about this in my ancient Greek philosophy class last week. Those guys came after 9/11.
Yeah, that's right.
Because for many people, they saw 9/11 as a religious problem, Christianity versus Muslims, and if we got rid of religion, then we'd have world peace. And it was a very simplistic notion of what religion is and how it operates with a lack of a lot of nuance that's necessary. So I know Bishop Aaron Word on Fire and a lot of Catholic intellectuals have been asking, well, what do you think God is? And then when the new atheists will say, well, we don't think that's we would agree with you. That's not God. So let's get to like who God actually is. And Charles Taylor, big author, when I was at the Angelicum, a lot of people were reading Charles Taylor, and he talks about the enchanted world or the enchanted self. And then once you hit like this period of rationalism and modernity, that everything needs to be explained by science. And that so anything that religion brought was superstition, it was myth in the worst sense of the word, and there was this great separation between faith and reason, which is at the heart. I mean, that's my license plate on my car. That faith and reason work together. They're both help us achieve truth, and they're both necessary. And in our Catholic tradition, they're not in competition with each other.
Right.
It was a lot more of the evangelical churches that made the decision: you believe in faith, or you can believe in science. But if you those two can't work together harmoniously.
Right, yeah. It's almost like you can – I think what they're really saying is you can believe in empiricism. You know, things can be seen and touched and felt, and those are the only things that exist, right?
Right.
Or you can believe in biblical literalism. And there's a great big piece in the middle that they're missing.
Yeah.
We don't believe in political and biblical literalism as a church, you know. There are people who do, but that's not Catholicism.
Yeah,
and
I think the other struggle is that Catholicism has that strong built. We have such a huge history, and philosophy has always been a part of how we understand what we believe in and how we articulate that, and that you know. The atheist doesn't have any of that, and they don't have to have any of that because they just say, I don't believe in any of that stuff, and I don't have to have a defense around it. I just say no. And that's – so it's difficult, I think, to even
have a
valid argument with someone. And I'm always trying to find the inroads to the conversation. I think that oftentimes – and I – you guys, I'm sure, will know who it is. The person that said, it's not that people disagree with Catholicism, it's they disagree with what they think that Catholicism is. And I have found that most of the time that whenever I go to have a conversation to ask, well, what have you read? What do you know about? What have you experienced that we could start a conversation with? But to get us back to, you know, what are young adults saying? I mean, there was a Kara study in 2018, and there were some books written. One of them I know that's like Going, Gone by Bob McCarty and John Witek. And they said that there were primarily the three categories, which I think we've already described here, the injured, the drifters, and the dissenters. So for sure the dissenters we've talked about and the injured. But the drifters, what about the moderate Christian that's kind of like they're not sure? The agnostic almost. What do you guys make of that?
Yeah. So, like, tell me a little bit more. So the folks who are drifting away are like they sort of buy this, but then they sort of don't buy this, right?
Yeah, like, I think maybe it was like we grew up going to church, but the whatever faith formation or catechesis
didn't take.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's something about even the word drifter that speaks to a passivity. Like you are allowing yourself to be carried by whatever current is flowing. So there might be a little bit of spiritual laziness there too. And some people will admit it, like, I know I should do this, but I just kind of don't. I'm just kind of drifting. And sometimes it's a death or a sickness or a marriage or a baptism or a funeral or something that can wake someone back up. So, there's a lot of that, I think, that I'm familiar with the title, but I don't remember the description of exactly what a drifter was. So
I often say I want to write a book called Do You Have an Eighth Grade God? Now it might be more like a Second Grade God.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, my faith formation reached its zenith at confirmation at best.
Yeah.
Right? You know, and I've never really picked up a book since then.
Yeah.
About religion. And so I'm sort of stunted in that area. And now my adult critical reasoning doesn't meet with my childlike faith. And so now I have to kind of try to figure out how to navigate this. And some people are like, that's just too much work.
Yeah.
And they just chuck it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then other people are like, are sort of more hungering for, no, how do I put this back together now? And I often think that's our job. Our job is to help people put this back together in a way that meets with their critical reasoning as well as the faith tradition that we're giving them.
I was thinking along a similar line, one of our responses as the church has to be that we can allow people to see meaning in their life and what life means.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because everybody is searching for meaning, even if they don't name that meaning God, or if they don't name that meaning eternal life or the good life or human flourishing. That is written in the human heart, and that's a nice place to enter into conversation. Like, what do you think life is about? What does it all mean? And those conversations can go a lot of ways, but at least you're getting somewhere. You have some traction then. Like, there is, and then if they say, well, there's absolutely no meaning to life, and there's nothing, then why do you do what it is that you do?
Why do you wake up?
Yeah. So to these are really basic, fundamental, even philosophical kind of conversations. But the culture doesn't encourage us to have those things.
Yeah,
the culture
right.
encourages us to stay distracted and don't think too deeply about anything.
Right. And be productive.
So one of the things the church can do is to slow us down. I mean, this is the great thing about Advent. To take the time to rest, to take the time to think, to take the time to pray, to take the time to be in the presence of the Almighty God and consider what transcendence looks like and life looks like, you know.
I think, though, that's exactly what's so stressful for people that don't have the connection. One of the things I hear most often is it's hard to go to church because there's quiet, because there's this is a moment where we're being reflective. And if I'm not reflecting on something transcendent, then what in the world is going on in this quiet space whenever I'm used to so much noise and busyness?
Can you stand yourself?
No, I can't.
That's
please.
It. I mean, that's a problem, that if you can't stand yourself, you don't want to be alone. Because then you'll be in your thoughts and you'll be like, oh my gosh. So that's the end. And the Lord can stand you.
Yeah.
Like he likes to be with you, even if you're a mess, a complete mess. Yeah. That's the whole point of the incarnation.
Yeah. But can you stand the Lord is a bigger question.
Yeah.
Right? You know, are you able
well,
to sit
can
in that
you,
space?
Can you allow, because I think the other is like, there was a book that I just read recently that the author talks about right in the very first chapter about being in competition with God. We're not in competition with God. That this idea that, like, you know, God's going to come and be like this eternal judge and be like, look at how terrible that you are and I can't even stand you, because you're already saying that about yourself.
Right.
And so there's where the struggle is. Instead of – and I, to me, like, it blows my mind because I'm like, that's exactly the opposite of the way Jesus was in the scriptures. You read them and he's constantly going where, like, the dregs of the earth are and grabbing hold of those people and saying – come on in, let's talk about it. Let's be together. I love you. You know, we can do this. So, for folks, just say give it a chance. But like, how do we invite young people back into that revelation.
Even to consider like the two most prominent images of Christ in Christian art, the cradle, where there's our nonviolent Lord comes in. He's wrapped in swaddling clothes. He's surrounded by animals and his Virgin Mother Mary and Joseph. And no one's going to harm you there. Like, he just wants to be in your presence. And then on the cross, even in the violence of the cross, he's pinned to the cross. He's not going to come down and throw lightning bolts at you. He's just, in both situations, he's showing you his love, his non-competitive nature, his non-violent nature, and just wanting to win you over, you know. And as we're in the Eucharistic revival, I often say, like, who's afraid of a host? Yeah. Like, if he's going to come as anything, here I'm going to come and disguise myself in bread and wine. What? Yeah, because that's the way that I just want to come. I want to come into you, you know.
And to give you gifts, you know, to nourish you literally, right? You know, I always say Catholics do the hard things first. You know, if you could believe God could unite with this piece of bread and this cup of wine and say, that is now myself, and now please eat this, you know, so I can be with you. You know, God shares his life with us.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You know, in baptism as well as, you know, and then we deepen that in confirmation. We deepen that again in the Eucharist, and we forget all that, you know.
Yeah. Another book I read recently was Eve Tushnet's book, Tenderness. Eve Tushnet is Catholic. She's a lesbian who lives according to church teaching.
Yeah.
And what she says in there is, if I can trust what the church teaches about the Eucharist to be true, then – as mother and teacher, I can entrust the church with other teachings too. Mm-hmm. But it comes out of what she believes about Christ and in the Eucharist. I thought that's a pretty cool argument. And she says, and I trust the church not as like this institution patriarchy, but as mother and teacher.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And there's some warmth there that she finds that I thought, well, that's a pretty cool argument.
Yeah.
Eve. Yeah.
Cool. All right. So I think we've covered all this. And let's take a look at a church. You know, our ice cream for nine nights that we had in December was Bernadette's friend, so that maybe we should go to St. Bernadette's. And
so the one thing I know about St. Bernadette's Church is that their sanctuary is modeled after Borromeo Seminary's old sanctuary.
Oh, right, yeah.
Where the ambo had engraved on the front, in the beginning was the Word, and then on the altar it said, and the Word was made flesh, and then on the repository altar where the tabernacle stands, it says, and dwells among us. And St. Helen and Newberry has that same thing going on. And I think St. Joe's in Amherst, too. And that was all a tribute to the old Borromeo Seminary Sanctuary.
Nice. Cool. And that's in Westlake, right?
Mm-hmm. Father Phil Rocco is the pastor, and Father Joe Menkhaus, who composed the Eucharistic song for our diocese, is the parochial vicar.
Yeah, Lord, I am not worthy, which is great. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then our gospel for the Epiphany, which is this weekend. When Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of King Herod, behold, magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, where is the newborn king of the Jews? We saw his star at its rising and have come to do him homage.
All right.
The kings, we three kings of Orient.
I take a line from the kings whenever I travel, most times when I travel, and that is, I usually go home by a different route. So if I go one way to a church, then I try to take at least a couple different turns the other way, so I went home by a different route. That's the Catholic imagination.
I thought I was the only one who did that. That's interesting.
I also do that. But I also, about the wise men and Epiphany, I had a Christmas play that I used to do with kids about the three wise guys, and all throughout the play, they say, we are wise, we are guys, we're a bunch of wise guys, which is hilarious. The kids generally love it. But I love it that you have this correlation with Isaiah, which is the first reading for this weekend, and the description of folks coming from all over and with the dromedaries and bringing the gifts, and that the gifts of the entire ocean are being poured out upon us through the gift of Christ being born among us. So, I mean, it's just so beautiful. Epiphany, like light bulbs going off and the big star and it all, so much symbolism. It's fantastic.
Speaking about light bulbs going off, so going back to the faith and reason business, in 2005, I went to World Youth Day. I was a priest then, and I took my youth group from Hudson, and Pope Benedict was Pope, and the gospel he picked for that Sunday was the three wise men, because he wanted to preach about faith and reason, and these were the scientists that were coming and were actually seeing that the fulfillment of their deepest longings and their intellect was fulfilled in the flesh and God right here. And then second, If you remember recently, we were talking about our Christmas traditions down on the floor, and Lynette said that in the Puerto Rican community, Christmas isn't as big of a deal as Epiphany.
Yeah.
And one of the things that she would do as a little girl was put little water out for the camels who were walking with the Magi to get to the Christ. And I thought that was really dear.
To feed the camels. Día de los Reyes,
yeah.
The Day of the Kings, yeah. Well, nice. Awesome. That's nice. Awesome. All right, so that's Matthew's Gospel for this Sunday. Christy, great having you.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. It was a lot of fun.
Will you come back again, please?
Anytime.
And you have your own podcast, don't you?
Oh, thanks for whatever the word is.
Plug.
The plug, thank you. Yeah, it's called the Catholic Leadership Network Podcast, and we are talking about all of the things that you didn't know about ministry from the very beginning.
Yeah, so it's you and
Sarah Jarzembowski.
Sarah Jarzembowski, our mutual friend. Whose husband, Paul, works for the bishops. Yeah.
Yeah. He does.
She sounds like she would like Cleveland with pierogies and kobasi with the last name.
Well, she's a Chicago girl.
There's a lot of Polish people.
She's a Pennsylvania girl.
Well, originally from Philly, has a lot of
Bring her on the show sometime. Bring her on the show.
Love that.
Yeah. So we'll have all that and a whole lot more in this new year on Question of Faith.